Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 191 on how to become a real estate developer with Adam Gilbert. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars and more in the business of real estate. Before we get started today, I have a quick announcement. Here at Diamond Equity Investments, my house flipping company, we are seeking new full-time acquisition managers interested in joining the team and quickly closing a large volume of deals. We have plenty of leads, plenty of capital, and a culture of growth, training, and support. Currently, we are looking to fill this position in the Philadelphia market, Chicago, Atlanta, and the Phoenix market as well. Full details about the position, responsibilities, and income expectations can be found at dealswithroi.com/careers. Some of my best partners have come through listening this podcast. Maybe you're the next. Today's guest is Adam Gilbert, the president of The Firm Commercial, where he leads a team of agents specializing in commercial real estate sales, leasing, land acquisition, development, government relations, and value-added land entitlement development deals. Any real estate agent, developer, or investor will generate a consistent income through positioning themselves to receive a continuous flow of deals that are coming across their desk. Adam has a unique way of doing this in the realm of commercial real estate, as discussed during this episode. And we also dive deep on how to become a real estate developer, covering details of a few recent development deals. And we also touch on the Palm Springs, California real estate market. Let's begin.
All right. Welcome to the REI Diamond Show, Adam. How are you doing today?
I'm doing really good. It's a beautiful day here in Palm Springs, and thanks for having me.
Nice. I was going to ask the question of where at in the world you were tuning in, but you've just location stamped yourself. My listeners know I'm in Chicago, and we actually had snow here, and we're talking about like the end of April almost. But I love it. You know, I'm sure it was much warmer in Palm Springs.
A bit. It, at this point in the year, it could be very hot or pretty temperate. And today was just one of those perfect, it's like 77 outside and just like
sunny. Oh, nice.
Perfect. So
even in the summer, is Palm Springs kind of desert, not too humid and still enjoyable? Or are you talking like a $110, $115 during?
Oh yeah. It's dry as hell, but you know, it's super hot. So you pretty much survive the day, but at night, you know, it's like 95 and you get to wear shorts and go out. It's really fun.
95 at night.
That's how we justify it in our heads, right? But
I like it. I like it. So I was doing some research for our show here, and I found that you've recently exited your vacation rental business. So I'd like to begin right at that point, if we could. And maybe you could touch on kind of how you built the business, how it operated at scale, and then what was the ultimate reasoning that led you to selling and exiting?
Sure, sure. So quick background, I'm born and raised here in Palm Springs. I left for school. I came back in about 2011, which was an interesting time in the market for a variety of reasons. But that summer, I had stayed in this new thing called an Airbnb in 2011 in Washington, D.C. We had spent the summer in New York, and my wife was like, we're going to spend the night in someone's room at their house. Like, this is crazy. we did it. I'm like, this is the future, honey. Like, this is crazy. This is going to be amazing. So when I moved back to Palm Springs, we have like a long history of vacation rental properties for, you know, 50, 60 years, but not like on the platform of Airbnb. So I was one of the ones who got, you know, just a couple of condos on the platform, and they just started crushing. Like, absolutely amazing. 'Cause this whole new marketplace of people were, booking properties on Airbnb. And so it kind of just grew organically. I was like, okay, well, I've got a housekeeping service. I've got a handyman. You know, I know how to do these reservations. And we just built this business. By the time 2018 came around, I had 35 full-time properties. We had like 50 around time Coachella came. And it was a great business. It is a very labor-intensive business, and it takes a lot of time, and it's holidays and all that kind of stuff. So at that point in my real estate investing career, it was just a little bit too much. And so I made a deal with Turnkey, who's a venture-backed vacation rental company out of Austin, Texas, and they were acquiring small companies like mine at the time, and made an exit and focused my attention on kind of other ventures.
Okay, so was it more of a freedom thing, or was there some timing and pricing that also made it worthwhile?
There was a few factors in there, just the perils of running a business, partners, all that kind of stuff. But I think it was more timing. I had to decide. It was that point when I had 35 properties. I would have needed to invest in the business in terms of employees. And I did some calculations. I wasn't going to make any money again until I got to like 75 properties. And I'm like, okay, like, is this what I want to spend my time doing? So it's kind of just like a 80-20 principle thing of like, where am I going to focus my time to have the best ROI?
Gotcha. So what's been the focus of your career since 2018? You exited, you jettisoned mm-hmm. the responsibilities, which was kind of what I was expecting you to answer there. Mm-hmm. So what's been the focus since then?
Yeah. So mostly since then, it's been a building of my real estate brokerage, both commercial and residential here. It's mostly commercial, but on the residential side, I do specialize in short-term vacation rentals, which the Palm Springs market is well known for and has been absolutely blasting since COVID. Palm Springs has been a great market since that's happened. And then also working on my own deals. And I kind of have like a little niche in value add entitlement deals and zone changes. And so I spend a lot of my time kind of doing that and entitlement work.
Gotcha. What is Coachella for those of us who are not initiated?
So Coachella is it's one of probably the most popular music festivals in the world. And it started, a little over 20 years ago on the polo fields in Indio, California, out here in the Coachella Valley. And since then, it's been home to some of the, biggest and most watched concerts of all time, the Tupac hologram and, bands getting back together. So it's a huge economic boom for our desert in and around April.
Nice. How many days is that festival?
So it is now, it's 3 days. And okay. It's two weekends back to back. And then following that is Stagecoach, which is the country music version. In October, Golden Voice, who does these, they also did a Desert Trip a couple years back, also known as Old Cella, where they had Paul McCartney, Rolling Stones, The Who, Neil Young. So a lot of like big concerts. And so it's become a pretty big outdoor concert venue, but it's about $1 billion of economic impact each year just in those polo fields.
Wow. What is the, what's the going rate for like an Airbnb, two bed condo when Coachella's in town?
Yeah. So a two bed condo is typically like $250 a night. Around Coachella, it's about $1,000 a night.
Nice.
We had some really nice homes in and around the polo fields that we rented out to like Kings of Leon, the Anaheim Mighty Ducks, like big people. A typical house that would go for $1,000 a night goes for $10,000 a night in and around that time. So there's big money. And at 25% gross rents, like there's a reason why that business was a little appealing at the time.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, and then you probably offset that. Like some of your comments were like, okay, I wasn't going to make any money. So there's like a certain percentage of the money that you're making from a 35-unit turnkey business that is this, heavy lifting. It's the guys, gals who are partners in there sort of doing the management, sort of pulling some of the levers. And I know that for me, when I was uninitiated a few years back in Airbnb, I heard about some of those peak weekends in Airbnb. Mm-hmm. Oh, man, I'm doing this with mine. At the end of a year, it cost me like several thousand dollars to even own the unit. And I wasn't the guy managing. I had outsourced the management.
Right.
So I wasn't making, it would have been a broke even proposition. I'm just going to rent this thing out. I got it. I didn't really distract myself from my main business, which is buying and selling houses. And we do, you know, several hundred a year at this point. But looking at the end of the year, I didn't make any money. So it's like, you know, I guess the shiny object is the Kings of Leon paying $10,000 for this night. Like, oh my God, I got to be in that business.
Exactly. And also it's just like, oh, you know, you have to do a spot check and make sure that the property is not, you know, oh, hey guys, how's it going? You know, you get to meet them. So that's really fun. But I thought I was a genius when I started the business because I was 25 years old and I was like, wow, you can get 25% of gross rents. Like I'll just manage four of them and have none of the risk of owning the real estate, which because in 2011, like we had just come in from a 2008. And so owning real estate was risky, not realizing that if I would have bought all these properties at the time, I would have had so much equity growth. I probably wouldn't have to be slogging as much as I am now. So, you know, it's just funny how your perspective changes and over time.
So what was your reaction? What thought went through your head, Adam, when the booking came in on the Airbnb app and you saw that one for like one of the biggest first ones that came in from What did that feel like?
Oh, it's awesome. You're just like, no way. Someone like people have, you know, like people are really willing to pay that much money. And it's like, yeah, but a lot of times it's, you know, it's their booking agent, it's their business manager. That's nothing to them. And so it's just like the perspective is crazy. But I was just like, wow, that's a $50,000 booking. That means I get 25% of that. Oh, great. You know, like I'll get $12,500 for one booking, right? Like I wish every month was April. So
nice.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Yeah. And I kind of was, you know, I'm leading into that. You're saying that the money comes in, you see this $50,000 booking come in, and there's probably, you know, if you're doing real estate deals, 50 grand for like a house or a small condo, right? You're like putting a down payment down. So you're kind of, I guess where I'm going with it is for people in the real estate, I know for myself, there was just like learning of how to do math with bigger dollar amounts as time goes on. You know, I remember feeling like a celebration moment. The first flip that I did, I made like $22,000 or something. Mm-hmm. Like I'm retired. This is it. It's over. Now we've done them at 125 million in profit with the partners and, you know, it's right back to work and we keep the nose to the grindstone. So there is this graduation of dollar amounts, if you will, that we go through. Did you have any of that? So your mind's blown. You look at this $50,000 one in a weekend, you're making 12.5. But were there in the other angles of real estate, as we're going to start talking about some commercial real estate development things, was there a noticeable increase in the math of the dollar amounts for you personally, Adam?
100%. And that's actually a pretty funny story of how I like really jumped into real estate. So I'm a lawyer by trade and I moved back to Palm Springs to jump. I went into my family's law firm and I was practicing law. And so it's 2011 and my uncle was like, you should sit for your broker's exam because you can as an attorney. And you know, we'll do a flip, you know, it's 2011, the market's going up like 13% a year, like nothing. Like we all thought we were geniuses at the time because, you know, it was so easy. And so I don't know what I'm doing. I'm my own broker. He finds this like $800,000 property in a New Balls Country Club. And I fumble my way through my first deal. And it's, you know, so I get a check for $20,000 for this real estate commission. And I was like, that's like a fifth of my salary that I made in 10 hours. Like there's something to this. And so that's when like my brain exploded. But then I remember, yeah, like you have like the $50,000 check and then the $100,000, then the hundred. And like, I remember being my wife, we would like go out to dinner and celebrate. And now it's just like another deal, you know, it's just dollars on the, it's just numbers on the screen. Right. And so you have to like keep doing new things to get that excitement going. And so that's, I guess what we're chasing that, that white rabbit for the rest of our lives. Right.
Yeah,
trying to get that thrill.
True enough. Like I don't know if the thrill went away and I suddenly have this like sense of just the game and it's fun and like not to take away, I'm sure you and I both would agree. Like, we're grateful for the position that we have in life. And there's people listening who are like, oh yeah, I can't wait to get there. And there's probably a few people who tune in and are like, ah, these guys are like joking over these hundred. That's nothing to me.
Yeah. I know some of my friends are gonna be like, you douche.
Yeah. Right. But it's suddenly it's about the game, you know, it's about putting the next deal together, finding it, seeing it come together, watching the closing happen, solving the problems. And I'm doing on this like small single family side and we're not in California. We're in Atlanta, Chicago, and the Philadelphia market. So we're talking, you know, 250, 300 median home prices. And that's kind of our specialty and our niche. And we do a volume and we feel like we're leaving a wake of renovated houses, you know, a tale like where we've been, there's, you know, transformations that occur. And that's where I think the satisfaction comes for me. And one of the successes that I found that you had, and I may be wrong in this, but you did the redevelopment. I think it was the Bump and Grind Plaza. Could you tell me more about that one or correct me if I'm wrong?
Yeah, no, definitely. So that's a shopping center that is one of those ones where like I pass by it every day for like 5 years and it was completely 100% vacant. And I was just like, someone's got to do something with it. So it wasn't available for lease. It wasn't on the market. It wasn't available for sale. 16,000 square foot retail shopping center. And so I call the owner and I'm like, hey, like, you know, what's the deal with this? Like, would you be interested in selling it? And he's like, oh yeah, I've got like an offer. And I'm like, yeah, right. Like, you know, of course you do. And so long story short on that, I put a deal in together. We got some seller financing and I was able to sign two leases on this property that hasn't been rented in 7 years while I was in escrow. And so like, wow, I can lease this thing, right? So buying retail in 2019 is always fun. So that's been, you know, I'm still working on this deal as we go, but you know, I leased it up and then COVID happened and I lost a couple of tenants, but I made it through. I got a bridge loan in November of 2020 and we're doing a full facade. I'm now at 93% leased. You know, I bought it for 1.5 in 2019. I got it appraised in November of 2020 for 3.2. I didn't do anything except sign some leases. You know, once we're done with the facade, it's going to be a great investment and I hope to have it forever and, you know, refinance it at some point and buy some more buildings. That's always the goal.
Nice. What do you think it is with the other owner that he sat there with this vacant property for 7 years and then you signed two leases within a 45, 90 day window, I guess, right?
Yeah. So that particular owner was based out of Beverly Hills and it was probably the smallest property in his portfolio. It was his redheaded stepchild in the desert that he didn't care about. And he's just like, I mean, he's, you know, told this property management company, it's just like, don't make it, you know, I don't want to pay for TIs. I don't want to fix up the building to, you know, do what I have to make it a successful center. And so that's where I saw opportunity, right? If I'm willing to put in the sweat equity of getting the lease assigned, get the facade approved, you know, pay for these TIs. And I've just thrown dollars after dollars into this building. But by doing that, by doing the work, I'm able to create the value. And that's what I love about value add is just, you know, someone can look at it and see like a defunct building. And I just like, this is a great opportunity, right? Like, yes, I can make so much money with this type of property.
Yeah. For me, I guess I'm so in the lane of the single family. Like I know what it costs to renovate them. I know what it costs to buy them. I have a really good idea of what they're going to sell for when it's said and done. If I could sell it as is, I know what it's going to sell for. I am probably so deep in the groove and we stay at the niche and we're good. But whenever I take a glance over at like the shopping center deal, I can sort of underwrite it, but I know I'm a little bit out of my depth. And man, if I see like 16, 18, 20,000 square feet of retail, I'm like, Amazon, nah, I'm done. I'll stick with the family. So
that's what's really funny is because I bought that when everyone was like, you know, retail is dying. And I mean, COVID happened, but you know, so it could still be the case, but I want that to be the dialogue, right? So I'm in escrow right now on another building. It's 20,000 square feet of office because everyone's like, office is dead, right? Like no one's going back to the office ever. And I'm like, in 2 years, we're all going to probably be back in the office and forget about all of this. And so I follow the trends of what people don't want and try to get that at great prices.
Yeah. And I think you're going to get some, you know, some great prices now. And if you have the fortitude and the creativity to market those properties, to sell those tenants and get them in there, I think you're going to stabilize the building. I mean, I don't know anything much about the market, but overall, I mean, you're not buying 600,000 square feet in the middle of a, you know, 100,000 square foot, 100,000 population area or something, some phenomenal thing. So it's, there's a strong place. I know that you're in a good spot doing that stuff. It's just not the place I'm confident to move to.
And we all just got to feel confident in those specific spaces, but I'm in commercial brokerage, right? So I know what calls I'm getting. I know what tenants want to see. I know what they're looking for. And so that's why I do what I do, because I'm in my business, right? Just like, you know, your business, I know exactly what's going on in the market. And so I can follow that.
Yeah. And to your point regarding office, our company is growing. And like, we just signed a lease. We're moving in on June 1st to like 11,000 square feet for our one location in Chicago. And we're going to grow into that. And we want to be in the office. So like, yes, COVID happened. I think some or most of us have gotten vaccines already. But we're looking
forward to it.
Yeah. You know, we're looking forward to being in the office. There's nothing like that camaraderie and that like level of energy, attention, development. I think you're right. I think 2 years from now, this is a distant memory. So regarding development deals, I have heard of and I've watched these sometimes decades long developments where the developer acquires and then assembles the parcels. Then they like rezone them. Sometimes there's like public right of ways they get rid of and they do a whole lot of legal work in the background to maybe entitle the property and then actually build it, or just sell the entire package and project as it is to reap a humongous profit. Or so I assume. I don't get to take a look at their books. Have you ever done anything or been a part of anything like that, Adam?
Yeah, definitely. And so that's kind of like my real special niche, I feel, because there's a lot of land and buildings that are just not zoned properly. And everyone's like, oh, like, you know, you see that defunct building, you're like, why has no one done anything with that? And, you know, we all have those buildings in our individual towns, and it's probably because it's zoned incorrectly or has some environmental issue or something along those lines. So I'll just give a quick story of a building. It was a 15,000 square foot warehouse in Cathedral City, which is right next to Palm Springs. And this was maybe like 3 or 4 years ago when it was the green rush in California and everyone was getting into cannabis deals, right? And so what I did is I put an option on this building to control it for a year and did a zone change of the entire block that it's at, because you can't do individual spot zoning. You can't just change one building. You have to change the entire block. And we changed it to a higher industrial use, which would allow for cannabis. And I mean, it's a long, drawn out process. It took me over a year. We got denied at planning commission, appealed to city council. And so it's one of those kind of like, you put all the money and time into it. And if you get the zoning designation, you win. And if you don't, you lose. But I equate it to like playing poker, where if I got two kings, you know, I'll play, I might still lose, but I know it's a good hand to play. And so I go and I do my due diligence. I do my research. I talk with the council beforehand to know that I've got a good chance of getting this done before it happens.
So what were the actual numbers? Because I like the idea of it too, right? Maybe it's $100,000 in soft costs, including an option fee. But if you can get that thing done, passed, approved, entitled, then maybe you can sell that entire project without having to close on it in the first place. Maybe you have a $2 million option, an option to buy it for $2 million. You increase the zoning, cost you $100,000, and it's worth $3.2 million. You sell it as newly entitled, and you're walking off with $900,000 to $1 million in profit. You have asymmetric risk, right? I'm going to make 10 times my money on this, or I'm going to lose the whole $100,000. I know that going into it. That's kind of what you described. So I'm curious, what were the numbers like, if you care to disclose them? If not, that's fine, on the 15,000 square foot building you described.
You're pretty much right on the money, except I'll say the caveat. So we put in the option for $2.1 million on the building, which is probably more than a little more than fair market value, but it allowed us to get the terms that we wanted and the time. We invested about $100,000 into the entitlement, city fees, you know, all the engineering and architectural costs. The fair market value at that time was, I think we put it on the market for 3.25.
How about that?
But it took us so long to get entitlement. And this is one thing, it's like, you know, everyone talks about location, location, location in real estate. Timing, timing, timing. And the amount of time that you have is the most important. We ran out of time for our option, and our guy was going to, he wasn't going to give us an extension because we just got the zone change. Like, and so he's like, I can sell it now at this higher and better use, right? So it was probably worth 3.2. We did a super quick sale, double escrow at 2.6. After commissions to their agent, we ended up, you know, with 2.5. 2.6. And then, we netted $400,000 on that deal.
How long do you think it would have taken, Adam, to find the right buyer that would have paid, let's say, $3 million, 3.1? Is that like a 1, 2, 3 year process? What else would have had to happen for that thing to have been even better?
If we had about 90 to 120 days to get something that will allow someone to do their due diligence, you know, to get their actual state cannabis licenses at the time, we could have done that. But we just ran out of time. And so they just did a super quick close, 25 days. But they got a steal. They got a screaming deal in the market at that time for the building. So it was a win-win for everyone. But lessons learned on that is just get as much time as you can. And I mean, I was still very happy. I used those profits to buy the Up and Grind. And so that's just parlayed it to the next deal and to the next value add opportunity.
If you were doing that deal all over again on day one, when you were getting the option, mm-hmm. what, cause I mean, getting a 12 month option for people who don't know the mountain that you're climbing with a seller who's got it on the market for whatever, and he wants his money now, you're getting this option for a year to do a zoning change. It's not an easy sale to make. So how much more time do you think you would have requested, dug your heels in, no option going into that deal, knowing you were going to put that $100,000 up again, if you know what you know now?
Yeah. And I'm actually doing a similar deal for a zoning change right now. And I asked for 12 months again, but I think it's probably about 16 months is really what you want, but it's really hard to get 16 months. No one really wants to tie. Here's my advice. And this is what I might still do prior to getting your actual entitlement so that the seller doesn't benefit from it. Say, hey, here's additional money. Here's another 50,000 non-refundable. Give me another 120 days or something like that. So that's probably what I'm going to do in this case. But usually like tying it up for a year is like the furthest that a seller is going to like feel comfortable with letting you tie up their property.
Yeah, because these are $1 million, $2 million, $3 million pieces of land. These are business owners who had this property. The property is now vacated. They retired.
They're savvy.
Very savvy individuals who know what they're kind of dealing with there. What moment, right? You know you're getting the entitlement, but they're not officially awarded. So maybe you have like some kind of like zoning hearing, and then they're like, we're going to issue this in 30 days. Like, what is the magic moment that someone else taking notes right now wants to know? Like, oh, once I have this, I go ask for more time because I know this is coming and it's going to become a little bit more public knowledge.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, each state I'm sure is going to be a little bit different, but for at least where I'm at in California. So for my new one, like there's all these little fun steps, right? So we just did our new one is within the airport zone. So we just did our airport land use commission, unanimous approval. Super easy. Next, we go to planning commission, and then we go to city council. And then even when you get your city council thing, it's 2 weeks later, they have a second reading where people can come and comment. It's just on consent calendar, but you never really know. So there's always these yays, and then like going back to being scared. Am I going to lose it all? Is like some, you know, grandma who's coming out of the woodwork who's going to complain about your project and the city council is going to take it back. But it's never really over until the money's in the bank, I feel.
Yeah, 100%. You can't count anything until it's closed and you've got the wire already.
Exactly.
Yeah, true enough. How much of that $100,000, if somebody's listening and they're not an attorney, they're not trained, like I'm curious how much of the work was done kind of pro bono by you that wouldn't be done by an ordinary developer, but yeah. You operate in a law capacity, like on your own behalf there.
Yeah, if you were hiring like a development company to do it, it would probably be another like $50,000 of actual like development work. But I do have legal training. I learned most of this stuff through like Urban Land Institute, like real estate development courses, and then just kind of learning. It's mostly city and public processes. So it is learnable to a degree. And who actually knows it is architects and engineers. And they can kind of guide you through it. But always remember, an architect and engineer is not a developer. They should not be the one presenting your project at council, because they're not excited about it, right? They're not salesmen. And when council like pushes back on something, they're like, oh, well, we want you to widen this road. They're like, yeah, we can do that. And so like, and then I watch these things and I'm like, that's going to cost you like $250,000. Architect doesn't care. He's just like, oh yeah, I just want to get it approved. Right. So like, you have to, it's like, you have to be the advocate and you have to understand the impact of what certain things are going to have on your project.
Gotcha. So, I mean, you know, hypothetically, how can I become a real estate developer? What capital requirements, connections, and skill set should I have before even attempting or thinking about developing real estate?
So, even with my legal training, I went and worked for basically free until he felt bad and started paying me a nominal sum, real estate developer in my local area for about 2 years, just being like, can I learn from you? You know, and so that was like a great experience. And that's where I learned most of the things that I learned. And so it's really hard to find a real estate developer who's going to teach you, because they're super busy. But if you can provide some value to them, or just watch city council meetings, if you need something to help you go to sleep, it's a great way to pass out. You know, go to the planning desk, talk to them, find out what you need. You know, a lot of times they'll have checklists of what the applications require. And then there are some development companies. So maybe you pay the first couple, a development associate, but learn the process through it. And then you'll have your education for life.
Yeah. And I kind of, you know, it's a loaded question. I think that my listeners have heard me talk about my own experience with doing a rezoning deal here in Chicago. And I remember we go into city council's meeting, and they're voting on legalized recreational marijuana in Chicago and Illinois. So it's like big time hot topic. The news reporters are there. Every alderman in the city is there. It's like an event, right? Not just like a normal council meeting. It's like an event. And my zoning attorney, who came through a referral, maybe it was an architect or somebody like that, but we were there to get the alderman support for our project. And this is like, it ends up, this conversation happens in this like side closet of a copy room. It was like a total, like, it was very strange and made it feel very political to get them to, okay, we're on board, we'll support the project. And he did end up writing the letters and support it, and we got the zoning change, and we're developing the two units additionally in there with no parking. It was a big hassle. I probably wouldn't have done it had I known what a long, extended, years-long process and all the expenses that I was going to incur. But I think, to your point, you know, my own education was worth it. So like, maybe the deals, the two units aren't exactly penciling out right now. By the time I had factor in the construction, I probably lost money on it. But I am that much more well-versed in what it's going to take to get a zoning change or develop in the city of Chicago, which is as much of a process as I imagine it would be anywhere in the country.
Yeah. And then when you do see that deal and you're like, wow, like there's this building and like I could put, you know, 50 townhomes on it, you know, on this lot, but it's not zoned right. Like, I can do that. And that's where the money's going to come in, because you've gone through the experience and you've prepared yourself. So yeah, it's just, you got to learn by doing. There's no book that will tell you everything. There's definitely stuff that will help you get close.
The only other thing I would say is that what scared me or even still would scare me is going into a deal like that. I mean, I'm at a different place now professionally in my career, got a little bit of money in the bank, so I could weather the storm of going through a difficult development. $100,000 turns into $120,000, $140,000, $150,000, $50,000 more for the option to be extended. Like, we're in $200,000. If I only borrowed $100,000 from investors, I'm sort of in a jam there. So properly capitalizing the deal. Were you in a blessed position financially, or did you actually have to do like a capital raise when you did your first deal? And were there any like psychological, mental barriers you had to like overcome as you were like saying yes to that first redevelopment deal?
Yeah. So the first deal I took on partners, because again, you just start with this much capital and then you get that much, but then it all goes out to different things. And so you're always kind of like with this little capital, right? So, I mean, it's always about how much cash that you can have to subsidize deals. But, you know, on bump and grind, you know, COVID happened and, you know, I needed TI money and I wasn't getting anything. So I had to come in and get a loan and do that. And so you just kind of figure it out. And you just have to have faith that you can get through it. But yeah, it's scary. But luckily, I mean, everything's worked out. Like the thing is, if you just don't give, I mean, at least for me, I'm sure there's some points where the market changes to such a degree that like you just left holding nothing, but I've been able to fight and just like claw my way through every deal to make sure that I have the capital to be able to do it. And if not, it's relationships and network to be able to say, hey, look, here's the risk, here's the upside. You know, you want to jump in this deal with me? And a lot of people, you know, who are doctors, lawyers, and don't understand real estate development, but have a lot of capital, they get it and they'll jump in.
Nice. Yeah. And I imagine the confidence has also developed. The 2 years that you spent at the desk of the guy, gal, whoever the real estate developer that was already doing business, you get to see the moving parts of the deal. So you have a different level of comfort. Whereas like if I was going to before that rezoning that I did, I've never gotten to witness the numbers, the zoning, the process, none of that stuff. So I had no idea how much was going to go out. It was a very, very big unknown. So the point of finding someone and being able to like ride coattails on the deal, even if you're not going to get paid. I found it's really hard to pay attention to deals for me where there's not some of my own money or upside. Either my money's at risk or I have some upside in the deal. It's hard for me to pay attention all the way through the process, like to sit in on city council and watch John Smith's, you know, 15 unit condo development downtown Chicago. Like, dude, I'm busy. I got to get back to work. Doing some other. So it's hard to follow them all the way through to see how the numbers shook out. You know, 2 years, 3 years later, did they sell those out at the anticipated price? Like, how did that work out? But your way of doing it, I think, is beneficial. And if anyone has a similar path in front of them, like, man, you grab onto that and you go. Can you give me a little bit of background, me and the listeners, on the Palm Springs, California market? So like California market to most of us in the Midwest or on the East Coast or in the Southeast, we're like, ah, these are like $1 million, 1,200 square foot San Francisco houses. Is Palm Springs as overheated as that and, you know, muddied as that? Or are you able to, I don't know, fill me in on the background of how the market operates in Palm Springs.
Yeah. So Palm Springs has an interesting history. It's been, you know, it was like the getaway for Hollywood back in the 50s and 60s and then kind of had like ups and downs throughout. In about 2000, people really started falling in love with like mid-century modern architecture, which like Palm Springs is known for. And so we've had this like whole modernism revival movement. And so, pretty much, you know, we've gone up and up and up and it's become cool again. Cool restaurants have opened up, things to do. But as soon as COVID hit, we've had a market here that we have never seen before. Yeah. And it was a couple of different factors. One being that people stopped traveling internationally and we have a huge drive market. So we have San Diego, Orange County, LA, and then we have direct flights or people sheltering in place from San Francisco, Chicago, New York, Seattle, huge Pacific Northwest. So you have all these like super high money cities and they all want to get out of these dense populations. And basically when they come to Palm Springs and see what you can get for the money in California, it was like Disney dollars to them. They're like, this is a joke. Like for $1 million in Palm Springs, you can get like a 4-bedroom house with an awesome pool, like big backyard in comparison to the thousand square foot condo, right? And so unlike any time before, we now have 15 offers on the property, sight unseen, $400,000 over asking. So our market is just like insanity right now because you can do short-term rentals and make some profit back. Whether or not that's long-term sustainable, we'll just have to see. But it's been a silly market for the last few months.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So, I mean, I grew up in Philadelphia. I moved to Chicago like 5 years ago to be near my daughter. And she went back to Philly for college this year.
Of course.
Yeah, so here I am. But in Philly, we would head to the Jersey Shore. That was kind of the thing. Mm-hmm. Summertime comes and we would like migrate toward the ocean. And then in California, they're closer. You guys are closer to the ocean here. So now we're going to go inland to the desert area. What do people do when they're there? Is it like camping, backpacking, like, you know, enjoying the desert, dirt bikes? Like,
there is part of that. But I mean, when people think about Palm Springs, it's like martinis by the pool, right? It's okay. Like fancy like hotels and spas and like shopping. And in the 80s, like Palm Springs was like famous for its spring break. And like, you have people like with motorcycles and girls in thongs and like, and the council killed it at that time because it was getting a little crazy. And then we were pretty much dead. But now, you know, because of Coachella and because of a renewed interest in like kind of Joshua Tree, you have a younger demographic from like Los Angeles who find it cool again. There's LA Times article, it's the capital of cool. People are falling in love with the desert because they're coming for these arts, for the music concerts, things like that, and just falling in love with the climate, especially during the winter and kind of the quality of life.
That's pretty cool. What's the population in the area? Do you know?
So city of Palm Springs is a 45,000 full-time population with 5 million visitors a year.
Wow.
And so we've got an international airport. We've got, you know, all of these major hotels, but yeah, our full-time population is only 45,000.
So a very vacation, second home market driven type of and this, I believe you're a member of the EO, the Entrepreneurs Organization. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, and this probably ties into this complex question I'm in the midst of asking, EO membership, and you're doing this commercial real estate stuff, and this is a relatively small town. So like, is there that vibrant of a commercial real estate market in 45,000 where there's these different employment and business and things of that nature to really drive commercial real estate prices, maybe as hot as, or maybe not as hot as the residential market in that area? Do they kind of function two separately? And I guess how impactful have the relationships been with business owners from EO to drive your career so far in commercial real estate?
Yeah, definitely. So good point in two parts. So first of all, the commercial real estate market is definitely like, so like in other areas, like there's specialists, right? Like I specialize in industrial, or I'm the hotel guy, or I do this. Like you have to do everything here. Like there's not enough of like a segregated market. Like you have to be very much a generalist. And so that's why I sell residential homes. I sell boutique hotels. I'll sell an industrial building. I'll sell an apartment complex. You give it to me, I'll sell it. And then in regards to EO, so we actually don't have a chapter in Palm Springs because it is so small, and we don't have a large, you know, kind of business community at the level that would get you into EO. So the closest chapter for me is Inland Empire, which is like Riverside, Ontario. So I drive about an hour and a half for my forums and for my EO meetings and events to be able to go and connect with a different group outside of, I know most of the people doing things in Palm Springs. So I wanted to get out of the Coachella Valley, out of Palm Springs, to meet new people doing in different businesses.
So has that led to, you know, has that led to much real estate business looking at other markets, or has it been a more of a source of like inspiration, business and marketing knowledge that you've then applied in the specific lane that you're already in?
Yeah. And so, I mean, the great part about EO is that it's a non-solicitation network. And so you don't have to deal with like, here's my card, like, let's do business. But these people become your friends. And so you naturally do business with your friends. I'm doing three different deals right now with three different EO members in terms of like investment projects after I talk to them about my past ones. And I'm helping a lot of my friends and colleagues, you know, find their commercial buildings and, you know, they're renting. And I'm like, well, have you thought about buying a commercial building? And there's the concepts and the principles of how it works. And they're like, oh, wow. And now they're getting into commercial real estate, which is great. So it naturally flows from it. And it really is just a great network of people who are really trying to elevate themselves and elevate their business.
Nice. So I repeat the topic of risk on many of my episodes here. It's a topic that I have thought a lot more about personally in the last even 3 years compared to the other 14 or whatever it is that I've been in real estate. Obviously, we know we're taking risk and, oh, yeah, we're risking we're buying a house. We're risking we might run into more construction. Oh, we're risking we might not get the zoning approved. But I'm always interested in my guest perspective. And perhaps a good question for you would be like, how do you view risk tolerance versus investor protections and just the broader topic of risk in general?
Yeah, a really good point. I was actually just talking with my friend yesterday about this because I was like showing him my pro forma and we're doing a deal together. And he's like, wow, like I get you, like you really like understand risk, or like you're more way more risk tolerant than I am, because he's got a W-2 job and like he wants to have that paycheck. And I'm like, oh yeah, like I do have a higher risk tolerance than most, I would say. But then I look at other people and I'm just like, wow, that's like the riskiest guy on the planet. Like they're just like, they don't know what the hell they're doing. And they're, you know, like I don't own any crypto. And I'm just like, that's risk to me, because like I don't understand it and I don't know. But like when I look at a building that I like I've worked at and I understand, and it's like I said, what if I got the two kings, like I will make the bet, but I'm not just gonna like not look at my cards and bet. Right. And so that's kind of how I look at risk, is that for me and the deals that I see, like I see so many deals, the ones I pick are like the most cherry, because like, you know, I'm looking at deals every single day. So I'm just like, no. Like I've looked at all the deals. I see what people are buying and like, this thing is cherry. Like let's raise some money and do this thing. Right. Like this is the one. And so that's like how I evaluate the risk in my own head. But yeah, if you're like, can't get off the like paycheck train, like this is not the business for you. Because I have sleepless nights. I wake up in a sweat. Like, you know, am I going to lose everything? Luckily, at this stage in my career, I'm young enough where I feel like I can weather the storm, and I've learned enough that I could build it all back if I want to. But I think as I progress, I will lower the risk. And, you know, just like a stock portfolio, you know, as you get older, you go more in the bonds and less in the equity. So,
yeah, that makes sense. And I mean, I think of Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger talking about, I think, the circle of influence or something of that topic. And essentially, like, is this, or circle of competence is like what we're looking at inside my circle of competence. Like maybe crypto is not, and maybe like a bunch of people are turning into millionaires and billionaires all around investing in crypto. That may not still be a good idea for me if I haven't gotten that from outside the circle of competence inside what I know about. And like my own, you know, earlier comment about single family homes, I'm like dead smack in the middle of single family homes. If we're in the cities that I mentioned, Atlanta, Chicago, you know, Philly, I'm probably closer to the edge if we're talking about houses in the Inland Empire, Riverside, California, San Francisco. I could probably figure out how to underwrite that deal because it functions somewhat like this, the very center of my circle. But, you know, if we step out and we're going to do this like industrial warehouse development deal, I better find somebody who's got that in their circle of competence, you know, and that's probably part of the risk, you know, the risk profile that develops. But yeah, I'm just amazed at like people's lack of understanding of risk sometimes that they take. Yeah. And then on the flip side, you know, is equally astounding to your point, is somebody who will not take even a single solitary risk at all. Maybe it seems obvious to us because we're, you know, center of the circle.
Yeah,
guys, exactly. But, and they're like outside here. But what are you going to do? So are there any topics, questions that I probably should have asked you and I just didn't have the foresight to do so as we kind of get to our wrap up here, Adam?
No, I think we covered a lot of like pretty fun stuff. I think it's a good mixture of what I'm doing and on a day-to-day basis. And yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Nice. So do you have a book recommendation or two that you might make to someone like me, or maybe even a friend that was just getting into real estate, commercial or otherwise, who's like outside the competence circle there? What would they be if you could mention them?
Yeah. So I'd say the one, and this is a book that I get for any person who works for me, it is the book that inspired me to go into real estate. And it's Confessions of a Real Estate Entrepreneur by James Randall. And he it's the way that he thinks in that book is the way that I look at every deal. And my family calls me Mr. Outside the Box because I'll just like find another way around it. But like, that's exactly the type of things that he talks about. It's also a really good precursor to terms within commercial real estate if you haven't done that. And then I'll just stick with that one. Read that book. Trust me.
All right.
That's cool. My one recommendation.
I like it. So we end our shows with the crown jewel of wisdom. So if we were starting with like no money in the bank, 2021, middle or end of COVID, hopefully we're wrapping up COVID here. But you do have, you know, all of the experience, knowledge that you have now, but no contacts necessarily with the people. How would you get started in real estate if this were day one for you?
Day one, again, I would just, I would hitch myself to someone who knows what they're doing and learn as much as you can from them. There is no substitute for experience. And again, it just like what we're talking about with the risk tolerance, it's Dunning-Kruger, right? The people who have the least amount of knowledge have like the most confidence. And then there's just that parabola of as you get more experience, like, oh, I don't know anything. And then you become an expert. And then you're just like, oh, okay, now I have the confidence again. So it's like the people who are doing these crazy things, they don't know what they're doing. But the further you can get on that parabola and that curve of knowledge, and it has to be real deals. It can't be theoretical. It can't be in a book. Those can help supplement, but I would just hitch myself to the most successful person that I could find in town that will teach me what they're doing.
Yeah, I think that's great, man. It's something I didn't do intentionally. I didn't set out, even though it sounded like a really great idea the way you said it. You know, I'll just find the right guy, work for him exclusively. I was foolish. You know, I needed to be paid. I mean, foolish because I was broke and I actually had to be paid to pay the child support and everything. So I was back against the wall. I didn't really have the option at the time. But there were various people who I did over the years. We did a lot of deals together. And one of the things that I always, just like yourself and you mentioned, was like, I got to bring something of value to the table. What is Dan Breslin, who was broke, you know, bankrupt, bad credit at the time? I had no job, no W-2. Like, I didn't even have a car in 2006 when I got in the business. But like, what could I bring to the table that was valuable? And like, for a lot of people in real estate, at least what I thought was like, oh, I had to have tons of cash. I had to be this like rich guy. And then that's what I would bring to the table. But the trickier thing and the thing that was in lower supply than the cash was the deals. And if I can look at 50 deals, 100 deals, and I can find the two cherries, like you mentioned, and then bring those to the table to the fix and flip investor who was initially, who's now a partner of mine, you know, that's what I brought. I brought deals and I was, you know, going to do a 50-50 split and here's how we were going to construct it. And this is what's going to work. And that really worked out for me well. So I would just kind of underline the jewel. This is kind of how I got here today. And I did have to bring something of value. I wasn't able to just kind of like cold call, show up at some developer's office and like, yeah, I'm not going away. You're going to have to teach me the business. Like, hey, you got to find some angle, some valuable thing, some reason to,
yep.
You know, this is a buffet. You got to bring your potluck dinner if you want to sit at the table and eat even of the knowledge. So cool, Adam, I had a blast. Do you have some contact information or an ask of the audience you'd like to make?
Yeah, you can find me on pretty much every social media channel at AdamGilbert13. That's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all of them. Or you can just go to my website, AdamGilbertESQ.com, and follow me there and jump on my mail list. And I always have funny videos that I'm taking to properties and shooting around. So see you on the social webs, everyone.
All right, cool. Hey, Adam, thanks again. Really had a blast. I got pages and notes here. I had a great time and I thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
My favorite way to fund a fix and flip deal is by using private money. I did an episode on raising private money for single family flips a little while back, detailing my entire process with Joe Fairless, as a matter of fact, which you can find at reidiamonds.com by typing raising private money into the search bar. But what if you don't have access to private lenders and need money to get started? Everyone usually talks about hard money, and that's great as long as you have some reserves or a nice chunk of cash in the bank to show the hard money lender in order to get the loan. They like to loan money to people who already have a little bit of money, at least, to be able to cover the payments and any other ancillary construction items that may come up. But one little known and little talked about option is gap funding. And gap funding is a line of credit used to access the funds needed for reserves, business startup costs. I mean, there's really no restriction on how you use the funds. And it's called gap funding because it's used to fill in the gap. The team over at REI Pathway Funding can set you up with gap funding line of credit, which has an initial interest rate of 0%. And in certain cases, if you qualify, it does not show up on your credit report as it's structured as business loans. So to find out how much you might be pre-approved for, go to www.reipathwayfunding.com. Thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom that I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode? Sign up at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also access the 191 episode archive, searchable by tag, organized neatly there. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So in 2020, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 283 houses. And so far this year, we've done 112, mostly houses, a few were apartment buildings. And we currently have 160 more in our inventory. As I mentioned at the beginning of the episode, we are hiring. You can go to dealswithroi.com/careers to check out details on the position. We have three other ways that we can do business. Number one, if you are interested in having access to the best real estate deals in your market, in other words, access to deals that you can buy at low enough prices to actually profit after renovating and reselling, go now to accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, accredited investors who are seeking double-digit returns can sign up to receive private mortgage investment opportunity emails at fundrehabdeals.com. And of course, number three, I am always buying houses that I can flip and occupied apartment buildings with below market rents. I have to have some room to make a profit here. If you have a deal that fits that description in either Atlanta, Chicago, Philadelphia, or even Phoenix, please send me an email with the details. We are at the conclusion, my friend. Next up, we have Chris Craddock joining us on the show to share his method on how real estate investors like us can add $5,000, $10,000, or even $20,000 per month or more in additional revenue from their existing lead flow without any additional cost. I'll catch you and that topic on the next one. Signing off.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.